We thought that pluralism was going to be possible. We thought that the secular square was going to be neutral. Well, at least I did, and took for granted the actual reality that the Bible lays out, is that as religious people, we will worship and sacrifice to gods, either rightly or wrongly.
Welcome to the Stand Firm Podcast. We are recording this episode on Tuesday, August 19th, 2025. I'm Nick Lannon of Grace Anglican Church in Louisville, Kentucky, and I'm here, as always, with Matt Kennedy of the Anglican Church of the Good Shepherd in Binghamton, New York, and J.D. Koch, I think now officially of Holy Trinity Anglican Church in Hillsdale, Michigan. Gentlemen, how are you doing today?
Excellent. Thank you.
Great, Nick. Thanks.
And J.D., your first Sunday in the parish is this upcoming Sunday, correct?
That's correct. I'll be preaching. Won't be installed until the 4th of September, which is a Friday. But no, we're here. All of our stuff is here, still crawling out of boxes. But
praise the Lord.
Yeah, we made it. So amen. So it's exciting. A new chapter.
We'll be praying for you for sure. Well, before we get to our topic for today, I wanted to briefly update our listener about an issue we discussed on a past show. On episode 265, we briefly discussed Incarnation Anglican Church in Williamsburg, Virginia, a discussion in which we basically took as factual online reports that had come out about the inner workings of the drama there between the vestry and their bishop, Chris Warner. After that show, I received an email from a member of Incarnation claiming that those reports were misleading at best and at times completely untrue. For instance, he claimed that Incarnation had never been opposed to women in ordained leadership and that there was no great falloff in attendance after Canon Mary Hayes preached and celebrated communion there. Now, the three of us here at Stand Firm are not investigative journalists. We all have parishes to lead. Kevin Carlson and George Conger, who claimed also to have talked to insiders at Incarnation, corroborated those online reports that we discussed on their podcast, episode 927. So I referred this parishioner who contacted me to them, knowing that Kevin and George will do a better job at getting to the bottom of what's going on at Incarnation than we can. But just so our listener knows, and probably as everyone would have expected, there do seem to be two sides to this story. Is there anything that you guys want to add to that before we move on? No. Good.
No.
Maybe I'll just edit that question out. Okay, so on to the topic at hand. The internet was set abuzz a couple of weeks ago when CNN aired an interview with Doug Wilson, in which he and his staff talked about hot-button things like religion and government, sexual distinction and roles within the household and church, and more. We've talked about Wilson before, and we just talked about Christian nationalism with Miles Smith. Now, depending on who you ask, Wilson is either a terrifying patriarchalist villain or someone who hopes that biblical morals and principles would permeate the societies in which we live. Many people online and elsewhere responded to this interview. Wilson even took the time to respond to some of them. So guys, what did you make of all this?
Well, I mean, I thought that was interesting that CNN interviewed him in the first place, because he's always been presented as kind of a niche character, someone that doesn't have a lot of cachet beyond.
But now Pete Hegseth.
Right, but now Pete Hegseth is going to his church, and so I think this, the fact that CNN felt they were important to do an interview with him, is interesting. I also wonder whether the point of CNN doing the interview, even though from what I've heard and what I've seen on various podcasts, Doug Wilson is pleased overall with the way the interview went and the way they edited it. He doesn't think he was treated unfairly, but I wonder if CNN's purpose in this was just to. They knew he was going to say some extreme things, or at least from their perspective. And so they wanted to get him out there, kind of tie Hegseth to him and therefore Trump to him and do some damage, what they would perceive as damage anyway. That being said, I mean, Doug Wilson has said that it was a fair interview and they didn't edit the thing in crazy ways like they might otherwise have done. I thought, you know, look, it was Doug Wilson. As far as the content of the interview, Doug Wilson was being Doug Wilson. And so you either can't stand Doug Wilson and his theology and his understanding of the relationship between the state and the church and his post-mill optimism about the future, or you're fine with it. I mean, I personally disagree with him on some things, but I think he's been a really helpful voice with regard to homeschooling in particular, classical education. I think he's been great when it comes to raising children. We have six well-adjusted, Christian, disciplined, happy young adults that we've raised based on principles that I read in his book, Standing on the Promises, about 20 years ago, for which I will always be thankful to him for that. And I recommend that book to any parent who's got young kids. If you want to know how not to go crazy and insane when your children reach toddler age or teenage age, read that book, and it is so good. It is so helpful. Standing on the Promises.
I need to read it again. Thank
If you
you.
read it for the first time when you've got teenagers, it's too
You're
late.
it's too late, right? Gotta read it when you
No, I've
read
got
it
a
when
second round coming up though, and these.
read it when you're pregnant. But apparently, Russell Moore thinks that that book and other books like it are just like camouflage to so that he can smuggle in his extreme views once he gets you hooked in his childbearing philosophy. So, I mean, I think, he's a Presbyterian, and his views on the relationship between the state and the church are tend to be more Presbyterian-ish. I think Miles did a great job was it last week?
2 weeks ago.
We were talking about how the Anglican view of the relationship between the state and church is going to be different than the Presbyterian view. And I disagree with him, and I disagree with him a little bit on some of the nuances of how we should talk about what he said about slavery, because I'd like to address that at some point. And of course, the point about women not having independent vote, that went over like a lead balloon on a number of occasions. So we should I, I'm not we should talk about that, because I think that deserves some hashing out. But my overall view of the interview is it was Doug Wilson being Doug Wilson, and so no one who knows Doug Wilson should be surprised or offended or shocked that he said what he said, because he's been saying these things all along.
Yeah, I largely agree with that. I mean, we can talk about any of the specifics you want, but nothing he said was unknown. If you even go to his website, you can do the, go to the page that says Controversies About Me, and he's got, chapter and verse of all of the hot button issues. If you want to read about it, at least you read his perspective and his side. I think one of the more disturbing things for me was the way that he was immediately vilified by many otherwise Christians who otherwise I think should have at least considered him an ally. I mean, maybe like a crazy uncle, or maybe, however you want to describe it, maybe someone that you necessarily wouldn't necessarily join into full communion with. But, here you have a Christian pastor with a distinguished, track record of, at the very least, evangelistic preaching and teaching on CNN, giving what would have been at least a half a century ago, not a century ago, just standard Christian answers, which, you may again have a take exception to, and in fact disagree with. But the way that so many people who are within the Christian camp lined up to distance themselves and sort of posture and virtue signal that they wanted nothing to do with him was really disappointing to me, because I guess it should be unsurprising, but it's like, who did you, of the two people represented, CNN and CREC, Christian, which way Christian man, which way, whose accolades are you seeking, and whose approval are looking to gain? And it just for me, just as I looked in the online discourse, I thought, it was disappointing. Now, I should say, as a caveat, that there are more people who were standing up for Doug Wilson and his and the CREC now than there were, 3 or 4 years ago, when or whenever the last controversy rose. And so there is does seem to be like a trajectory of people appreciating that, despite our disagreements, perhaps this is a Christian brother speaking. And so I thought that was good. I thought the entrance of Joe Rigney and Jared Longshore, helped expand the target base, for lack of a better word. So it's, and those are serious people, thoughtful, authors, prolific preachers, teachers, who, again, we're not Presbyterians and we're not part of the CREC, so we can talk about all of the reasons why we may disagree with certain aspects of it. But I was heartened. We had my whole family, at least the adults, with CNN queued up. It was like watching a Super Bowl halftime commercial. We were ready to go and watching it go. And I haven't, to be fair, I haven't listened to the entire 30-minute interview, But I've seen enough of the clips. But I watched it live on CNN and couldn't believe what I was watching. It was like, well, here we go. Here we have. It was like watching that Wesley Huff interview with Joe Rogan. I was sitting there saying, Lord, whatever our disagreements are, this is amazing. And you are giving a voice to the voices. These are rocks crying out, for goodness sakes, in a way that I never would have expected 10 years ago. I thought we were all going to be sort of Morse coding underground caves, the way things seem to be headed. And so anyway, that was my initial reaction, was disappointment to some of the people who I had hoped by now would have at least kind of, even begrudgingly or maybe with an eye roll, said, well, that's Doug being Doug, like you said, Matt. And so I'm hoping that trajectory will continue, that maybe the next, in 5 years, when he gets to some other controversy and gets interviewed by, whoever the leftist political group think is, that maybe he'll have more allies than detractors within the Christian camp, I should say. But I do think, I agree with you also. They just let him run. They're like, let him hang himself. Like, this is, you go ahead and say, it's like I used to joke when Liza and I were in Berlin, and I think, we were, she was like 23, 24, a little older. I'm 3.5 years older, but, she looked like a child. We were married. I was ordained. We were Christian people, and we were like oddities that they had dragged out of, the 19th century. And so we'd go to these parties, and it was as if I was in a cage in the middle of the room, people walking around discussing us. And I think that's a little bit like Doug was on display for the CNN, and it was like, look at this man and what he believes.
I mean, the reality is the very common Christian consensus of like 20 years ago, 30 years ago, comprised the bulk of what he said, the idea that the husband is the head of the household.
You're older than
Yes.
you think. It's been more than 20 or 30 years.
Okay, well, whatever. It's been a comment. It's been four thousands
But
of years. It's
certainly
been
thousands of years, yes.
that the husband is the head of the household, and make that now is so shocking to our contemporary non-believers, and even some of our contemporary believers, that just saying it is, you like you say, you're an oddity. The idea that homosexual relationships should be outlawed, not just morally looked down upon, but actually outlawed, that also is like a shocking idea that nobody.
Even though there are still instances on the books where it is still technically illegal,
Right.
like around the US. I mean, it's.
But I don't see that the Christian can have really any other position. I mean, it's harmful to the people involved, both spiritually and physically. It's harmful. So it's biblically, God, biblical laws outlaws it, and imposes strict punishments. And as Anglicans, we believe that the estate is free to, is not obligated to, but is free to impose the same laws on its own citizens, and they're actually, they are good laws because God revealed them. Where I think I probably disagree with him a bit is, I think it would be great, ideally, to have family voting blocks where the husband votes for the whole family. The problem I see with it, though, is that it's kind of like you squeeze a toothpaste, you can't get that stuff back in. That speaks of an era that I think is far gone, and where we are now. I'm not saying whether that's good or bad. I'm just saying I don't see how we ever get there. Now, of course, he's a post-mill guy, right? So that means, in his view, we're headed there by design, by God's sovereignty. We're gonna end up in a post-mill world where the old understanding of family is restored. What were you
And
gonna
he
say,
did
Nick, over
say
there?
in his response on his blog to some of the reactions to the interview that it's really not so much about the man voting for the
That's right.
family as it is the head voting for the
Right,
family.
right,
And he said
right.
that if Lydia from Acts was a member of his church, she
Yeah.
would vote as the
Right.
head
That's
of her
right.
family.
As
It's
the head of
really
the family.
about
Right.
trying to get away from the atomization into
Yeah, and that's what
individuality.
I like.
That's
That's
right.
why. That's what I liked about it. You have the same principle in Deuteronomy 24, I think it is, where when there's no male heirs for property, but there are female heirs, that the females take the headship of the family. That's a biblical principle. It's not something that Doug Wilson made up. But people hear it and they think, oh, you're going to take our rights away. You're going to take
Well, and
our
he's
stuff.
doing that on purpose too, right? He's
Right,
very
right.
clear. This is a strategy like laid out. He's not hiding this. He has claimed that one cannot move the Overton window from within the
From within,
Overton
that's
window.
right.
You
And that's
have
true.
to make statements that
Yep.
shock people in order to move the discourse even an inch in the direction in which you want it to move. So he intentionally, as we talked about long ago, he intentionally swears when he doesn't have to. He intentionally makes lewd references in order to move the conversation to his own detriment for what he, I think, sees as the good of the broader public conversation so that it can move a little bit. I think that's the same thing he's doing when he insists on talking about the, I think, incontrovertible fact that there were some merciful slave owners in the American South and some slaves probably who were happy with their situation. He insists on saying that, which rankles 100% of the skins who are listening to him, including mine, because he wants to get the conversation moved a little bit where we can talk about what the Philemon and Onesimus relationship was really like. That's what he's ultimately trying to get to, but you can't have that conversation until, in his mind, you move the Overton window a little bit.
Well, I'm happy the way they edited that part too, CNN, because they did make sure to include where he said very clearly, chattel slavery is evil, and the system of American slavery was chattel slavery, and so it's good that it ended. So that part of what he says is rarely included in the discussion. So it was kudos to CNN for including that particular statement. But you're right.
But before we go there, though, I think that back to the women voting question, part of the reaction to it just exposes again, like the sort of the anemic understanding of history and the appreciation of the vociferous and intense debates that were about the 19th Amendment by women themselves, particularly married women and particularly Christian married women like Phyllis Schlafly types, you know, back in the day who prophesied exactly what has been the result in a negative sense for the enfranchisement of each individual over against the family, namely that it pitted spouses against each other. It sort of further atomized the relationships, and it contributed to, I don't want to say causation is causation or whatever, correlation is causation, but it certainly is part of the mix, which has undermined the importance and the sort of bedrock sort of aspect of the, it's not just nuclear, but a nuclear and extended family. And I think that if you go back and read some of the detractors and some of the prophets, you see them being borne out. One of the fears was that it was going to sort of, well, it was going to essentially masculinize women in a way that was going to be unhelpful ultimately for them in a cultural situation. You know, there was going to be a pitted battle between husband and wife if they even got married in the first place, you know, and all these nefarious fruit was going to be a result of this. And again, I don't think that there's necessarily the people would want to say, well, we have to put all the toothpaste back in the tube as a result of this. But to just talk about what toothpaste has come out, I think would be a helpful conversation.
No, I mean, absolutely. So I guess the questions I would have, and maybe we've already answered this, but the questions I'd have is, you know, I would trust my daughters to vote. If they're single, I would trust them to vote implicitly without any problem.
Women are heads of their own households.
Okay, that's right. Okay, so that settles that question. So I guess part of, and maybe I'm not sure where I fall on this, but I think there's so many great, wonderful Christian women I know who are going to vote rightly, right? So I mean, I don't. Is the problem that the extension of the vote, or is the problem the decadence of our society, and maybe they're linked? I understand that, yes, since women have individuals have been given individual votes, male or female, we've had, you know, abortion rights, we've had the degradation of our society. I totally agree with that. I'm not sure I agree that the answer is to take voting rights away from anybody. I'm not sure that that's the answer. So
I think an answer might be, and again, there's all sorts of ways you could define this, but would be able to define what constituted a household, you know, whether that was financial, you know, participation, whether it was, well, I think that would be one way of doing it, you know, a certain tax threshold, a certain, you know, investment for the future. You know, you aren't able to make a determination about what direction this country's going unless you've shown some, you put some skin in the game in some capacity. Again, I'm just spitballing here, but I think, you know, if you could determine what constituted a household, you know, even if you wanted to say it was some measure of age slash, I don't know, citizenship accomplishment, like the green card, like people that want to become American citizens have to, you know, undergo, you know, something. Again, I have no, I'm just thinking out loud, but if you wanted to clarify that and then take the male female aspect of it out of the question, I think you could probably have a more, at least less volatile
I think
conversation
it's
at
probably
this
right. I
point.
think it's probably right.
But I do think it is interesting, you know, that one of the fears is that, you know, people who have very little long-term investment, you know, whether it's in children or whether it's in just sort of hope that the country, you know, is still in existence in 100 years from now, are participating in our democracy. You see the rise of wanton spending, and this is a left-right issue. This isn't like those bad Democrats. You know, you see politicians have more than happily just kicking cans down the road for generations to the point where I think at last I read the national debt was cresting at $38 trillion or something, which is just an unfathomable number. Again, I don't know what the answer to any of it is, but I do think that to Nick's point, that we're having this conversation in part in a supposedly more palpable way because Doug Wilson took the hit for speaking way outside the Overton window and having the audacity on CNN to say maybe the 19th Amendment should be repealed, which, you know, I mean, maybe. And I wonder if you woke him up at 3 in the morning whether he would actually even really think if he had the power to do that, if he would. You know, Toby Sumter has been all over the internet saying, of course, he doesn't spend a lot of time thinking about that, but we are talking about it, and that was the point. And so, you know, to that end, he succeeded. But also to your point, Matt, and we can talk about it more, but his statements on slavery and race and the Civil War have exploded heads for decades now. Every time he, and of course, it's the number one thing people bring back out when they try to discredit anything he says. And I've read through a lot of it, and I guess I'm still reticent to even broach the subject.
Well, I mean,
So.
if I okay, so I, if tell me if I'm right, but my understanding of his argument in Black and Tan is that slavery would have the type of slavery that was endemic in the South would have ebbed away in time anyway without a war. So there shouldn't have been a war. It shouldn't have been necessary to have a war to end it, or even a as society became more and more Christian. It's kind of a postmodern argument.
That's the key factor. As society became more and more Christian, that's the argument that he takes from Philemon, where St. Paul does not write a letter saying you need to free this slave. He tells him that this is now your brother in Christ, and I know you, and I know that you'll do even more than what I ask, which is to forgive him. I know you'll do more than that. So it's been a little while since I read the book, but I believe the image that Wilson uses is that St. Paul sort of sets a time bomb into history there. The implication is that slavery will become impossible for people who are submitted themselves to Christ to perpetuate. And well, I was just going to say, and maybe this is out of place, but the main thing that I got out of reading Black and Tan was Wilson's argument that if slavery was this agreed upon abomination that we needed a war to end, why aren't we fighting a war to end abortion? Which is, in his mind, a much greater travesty.
Well, I mean, I agree because abortion is outright murder. I think where I disagreed with him in Black and Tan, again, I read it like 10 years ago. So if I'm not correctly articulating what he said, then I'm sorry.
I
But
only read it slightly more recently than that.
Well, I think that the type of slavery in the South is not comparable to the sort of slavery Paul's talking about in the first century.
That's true.
And right, so it's, the
It's
reason.
man stealing, which is explicitly outlawed in the Bible.
Exactly. So, and for that, I think, and I know the North's purpose in the war was not at first anyway explicitly to free the slaves. I understand that, but I do think that it would be a just war to do so in such a case because of the man stealing aspect of it. The man stealing was punishable by death, right? So you're not supposed to man's steal, and you're not supposed to own a slave who's been stolen. So the whole the idea that there's that the Bible New Testament defends slavery as an institution, I think, is suspect in the first place. But you're comparing apples and oranges when you try to say what's happening in the Roman Empire is what's happening in antebellum South. It just was not the same thing, not the same institution.
I recall Wilson at least acknowledging that the lawful Old Testament Israelite slavery, to use that word, is not analogous to chattel slavery. I think he did say that in the Roman Empire, chattel slavery certainly existed.
Right. But even that, you know, even it did. But that was more what you'd see in the countryside. You do it in the urban environment. The type of slavery you'd see would be more like the old covenant type envisioned in Leviticus and other places in Exodus, where the poor person needs to be able to survive. So he puts himself under the ownership of another person who provides food, clothing, healthcare, all the stuff he needs for a set period of time, and then he can go away. That was generally the way Roman slavery, and at least in the urban environments, worked as well. You'd be enslaved for maybe 20 years. During that time, you'd get food, clothing, all the stuff, training and a skill also. And so you'd leave the enslavement in a better position than you were than when you got out. So people voluntarily went into it. That just was not happening. No one voluntarily went into crossed the sea to become a black slave for a southern plantation owner. That right. just didn't happen. So anyway, I agree with the idea. I mean, I like the free speech aspect of this, where you just say things and it does move the conversation forward or backward. And that's exactly what the left has done for years, right? That's what the reason we're talking about polyamory now is because the left has pushed that right. outside the Overton window, right? So now the Overton, at least in 2024 or 2025 might be a vibe shift, but in 2024 you could talk about polyamory as a normal lifestyle choice, which you couldn't do 10 years ago, because people said crazy things about polyamory 10 years ago.
Yeah.
And so if we're going to move it back the other way, as Doug Wilson's trying to do, you know, there's some legitimacy to that argument. Or to that tactic.
Well, I agree with you there, Matt. And I think, you know, one of the things that's happening is these conversations continue. There are people who are, you know, of whatever ethnic background or whatever, even religious background, just simply looking at the facts of the matter and saying, how do we help, you know, people? How do we, you know, we look at schools, we look at family structures, we look at, you know, black, white or brown or whatever the color is, and saying, you know, whatever the ideology surrounding these discussions are that have prohibited us from just speaking frankly, let's wipe those away and talk about, you know, Appalachia, you know, talk about broken families in inner cities, talk about generational poverty in whatever capacity you're talking about. And let's see what we can do to address it. And I think that, you know, at some point, you know, it's like Margaret Thatcher's quip about, you know, the problem with socialism, at some point you end up running out of other people's money. You know, it's like at some point, the ideology and the power behind it, you know, that, you know, yelling racist, yelling classes, homophobe, xenophobe, whatever you're yelling, at some point, the currency behind that is going to run out, and you're just going to be left with broken, hurting people. And, you know, you're even seeing it all over the place. Like there's that show that keeps coming up, a quip where they have like one guy sit in the middle and there's like 20 people surrounding them with flags and they're having like a discussion. I forget what it's called, but there's always like either a conservative in the middle or a liberal in the middle and everyone. But even watching kind of, for lack of a better word, the racial diversity amongst, you know, otherwise 10 years ago, talking points that you couldn't even bring up, you know, about broken families or about, generational poverty or fatherless homes or whatever the case may be. It's, you know, part of what you mentioned, the vibe shift, is like, it seems like the next generation of people is maybe inoculated against some of this ideology and simply saying, hey, we're looking at the prospects of our future and we want something better. And so, you know, we're cognizant of the past, the mistakes that were made. They've set up some challenges that we are all facing, but how do we talk about them in a helpful way to get us out of this hole that you seem to be leaving us? You know, and I think that's part of the vibe shift. And call it, you know, whether it's in the area of like, you know, promiscuity. I mean, you see all the stats coming out and people are saying, actually deciding maybe we shouldn't just have, be like that, whatever that YouTuber Bonnie Blue or whatever, like maybe we shouldn't try to sleep with 1,000 men in a day. There might be some negatives to that, all the way to like perhaps we should, young men and women embrace, the lifestyles of our great grandparents, and all the capacities, even insofar as like let's move out into a farm and figure out how to, use goats to chew down the underbrush or whatever. And these are all, again, I think that the pendulum can always swing too far, but that's again where we're grateful for the patrimony and the faith once for all delivered to the saints. Is like we have, thousands of years of guardrails, that can sort of keep us in between the hedges, as it were, and hopefully not swing too far, towards sort of libertinism or legalism on the other hand. And leave something into the witness of salt and light that Jesus promised that his people would be in an otherwise lost and dark world. And I think we're seeing that. I think that it's unsurprising, as we've talked about, we're seeing young men and women, returning to church, in whatever denomination. There seems to be at least some interest. You read the reports from the UK coming through, Justin Brierley of that podcast, Unbelievable, seems to post something every 10 days about some, sort of quiet revolution taking place. And that's all to the good. And I think it's a reflection of the dissatisfaction with what has been promised for a generation, if not two generations now, and the lack of return on that promise, and I sort of, I don't resemble that remark, thankfully. And I do say that a lot, lots of put it out, just so you know, but I don't, I'm editing myself here. I don't share in that dissatisfaction exactly, because thankfully the Lord grabbed me at a young age and has not let go. But I do see some of the presuppositions that I took for granted, being challenged and being rethought in profound ways. And so, if we're doing that within a system and a faith that has, the unchanging faith that has kept us at the very least ballast, and anchored, you can only imagine how the whiplash in sort of your kind of average, mid 30 something year old who's finally realizing that all of the lies that they have been told about men, women, sex, money, power, hope, whatever has were all based, or many of them were based on ideological presuppositions that were baseless, the emperor's new clothes sort of thing. And that's what we're watching. And so, you get interviews with Doug Wilson where he says things that our great grandparents would have yawned at, exploding heads all over the world.
So one of the things that shocked the CNN interviewer, and I think maybe even sounded unpalatable to some of the Christian viewers of the interview, was Wilson's contention that he wanted to see people become Christians. Like, he was referring to wanting to see a Christian town and a Christian state and a Christian nation. And the interviewer brought up, I think it was Saudi Arabia. And he said that if he went there, he would expect to live under the laws of an Islamic regime. And she said, "Well, but you just said that everybody should be Christians." And he said, "Yes." And, not at the point of a sword, but that people ought to be told the good news about Jesus Christ. And I'm wondering about, is there more to this than just a simple lack of actual belief in eternity? I mean, certainly the CNN interviewer is probably so shocked because she believes in, everybody's right to worship as they wish here, because she doesn't actually believe that your right to worship wrongly here might lead to your eternal suffering in hell. But I feel like a lot of Christians have that same prickle. Like, shouldn't we be allowing people to worship as they will? And I think it betrays a lack of belief in eternity.
Yeah, I mean, people who are worshiping anyone else other than the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ through faith in Jesus Christ are worshiping demons. I mean, that's the reality of it, at least if we're going to believe the scriptures. And so I think the idea of religious and political plurality has become an article of faith to a lot of people, Christians included. And so, diversity is our strength has become a kind of mantra that people just believe. And I think you're right. I think it's a slogan and a mindset that is 100% horizontal and doesn't take into account the vertical. I think that the older understanding of things from the Christian perspective was, no, we don't want in our society people preaching things that are going to lead other people to hell. It's a dangerous, hell's not a good place, and we don't want anyone to go there. So our laws should reflect that notion by protecting our citizens from ideas and or religions that would lead them there. So I don't think that's a, I mean, I think that hit the reporter like a cold water, you know, that she, I'm sure she'd never heard someone express it in exactly the way that Doug Wilson expressed it. But it really shouldn't hurt. It really shouldn't hit Christians that way, because we have the scriptures, which tell us again about the vertical aspect of it. But also we have the church history, which, you know, Christendom was a thing. Nations governed by Christian kings and pastored by Christian churches. That has been the majority report for the last, until the French Revolution, I guess, and the American Revolution. So it's not a strange thing for a Christian to want to have a world that is governed by Christian authorities and that looks out for the people in a nation by preventing religious plurality. That's my view.
I mean, even the American and French revolutions are separate a little bit there. I mean, Adams specifically said he didn't understand what a nation full of atheists could even be. He saw early on that the French Revolution was going to end in a terrible chaos in a way that the American Revolution did not.
Right. And we shouldn't kid ourselves that we actually have plurality in our democracy. I mean, we saw this very clearly in the last 5 or 6 years when progressive secularists get the upper hand. They're going to enforce their beliefs on the rest of us by the force of law. So we're not dealing with let's be an open advocates of an open and free society versus the Shiites. We're dealing with advocates of one religious view who will impose it by force if necessary, as we've seen on the left, versus a typical Christian view. Now, I don't think. I mean, I think I heard Doug Wilson talk on this in an actual Christian nation. That you would put people in jail for being Buddhists or for being Hindus or anything like that. You just prohibit the spread of that, if I understand it correctly.
No, that's my understanding of it. I mean, and again, you would see the myth of religious neutrality exposed, just to your point, Matt, in that if it's not a explicitly Christian legal framework that we're working within, then it's going to be a pagan. It's equally religious, equally as spiritual, just going to be worshiping demons. And so, you know, in a demonic pagan society, you will be forced, you can believe what you want inside, but you'll be forced to celebrate sexual depravity, be forced to celebrate wanton infanticide. Essentially, you'll be forced to worship Molech and some form, you know, and have an Asherah pole at least in your center of your town, which, of course, the modern version is just a pride flag and a coexist bumper sticker.
Right.
That's right. And so then the question is, you know, to the meme, which way Western man, which way Christian man, you know, you will not have the ability to live in a religiously neutral society. And so as a Christian, which one are you going to advocate? Doesn't mean that we will return or if there ever really even was, if you read, what is it, William Kavanaugh's The Myth of Religious Violence book, you'll have a lot of your Goodwill Hunting liberal talking points questioned by by this book, The Actual Facts on the Ground. Don't make as good screenplays. But if you, you know, we're not looking to return to, I keep saying return, but now I keep thinking that, like, for instance, most people's, what they know of the Puritans come from Nathaniel Hawthorne and Esther Prynne, which is, you know, like thinking most understanding of Baptist should come from Footloose. You know, it's like that's so ridiculous.
Although the preacher's clearly the hero of Footloose if you watch
For
it as an
sure.
adult.
Just like the father in Dirty Dancing. We talked about that before.
Oh,
that's
yeah.
right. Dirty Dancing with a different soundtrack could be like a real, like a horror movie. at any rate, so the point being is that I, you know, and again, this is we keep reiterating this, but this whole conversation has been precipitated by some rather dramatic worldwide events that have exposed things that we thought had been hidden, if not eradicated. Like, you know, well, we thought that pluralism was going to be possible. We thought that the secular square was going to be neutral. We thought that, you know, or at least I did, and took for granted the actual reality that the Bible lays out, is that as religious people, we will worship and sacrifice to gods, either rightly or wrongly. And what we have experienced over the past 10 years in the West is the full-blown worship of demonic paganism, in the form of that it's always taken sexual depravity, you know, debauchery, the death urge, you know, as Freud would say, the death drive on full display, combined with well, essentially just the destruction of the human person as its end. And we are standing against that, you know, and use the Presbyterian phrase, the human flourishing, you know, that the Bible celebrates, is a direct opposite in almost every point.
Well, those are going to have to be words that we end on. They are good words to end on. That's going to be all the time that we have today. Thanks for listening to Stand Firm this week. If you want to keep the conversation going, be in touch with us, rate and review the podcast on iTunes, send us an email at mailbag@standfirminfaith.com, or join the Anglicans for the Gospel Facebook group. Thanks to J.D. Koch and Matt Kennedy. I'm Nick Lannon, and Lord willing, we'll be back next week. Until then, by the grace of God and Jesus Christ, we'll be standing firm.